According to our next guest, whether we're entrepreneurs persuading funders, employees pitching colleagues, or parents and teachers cajoling kids, we spend our days trying to move others. Like it or not, we are all in sales. As Dan Pink explains in his new book, To Sell is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. In it, he offers a fresh look at the art and science of selling. He shows that sales, whether pushing a product or peddling an idea, isn't what it used to be because of powerful economic changes. The glad-handing, truth-bending form of sales is a relic. In its place is a new approach to moving people that involves three very human qualities and four surprising skills, which we'll talk about in just a few moments. Daniel Pink is the author of several provocative best-selling books, including Drive, The Surprising Truth About What Motivates Us, and A Whole New Mind. He has provided analysis of business trends on all forms of media. He says he held his last real job in the White House, where he served from 1995 to 1997 as chief speechwriter to Vice President Al Gore. It's a great pleasure to welcome Daniel Pink to the program. Thank you very much for being with us, sir.
Joe, thanks for having me.
It is a delight to have you here. This idea came to you at what point in your life where selling is part of our human nature?
Well, you know, I started looking at what I do myself, and you know, in our day-to-day maw of activities, we sometimes don't really notice exactly what we're doing. So I said one afternoon, okay, let me figure out what the heck I've done for the last 2 weeks. And I looked at, you know, the meetings and conference calls and trips and tweets and emails, and I said, holy smokes, I'm kind of a salesman. I'm not only selling books, but I am selling magazine editors on this idea or that idea. I am trying to get a gate agent to switch me from a aisle seat to a window seat. At home, I'm trying to convince my son to take a shower after baseball practice. And I figured if I'm spending a lot of time persuading, convincing, influencing people, selling in a broader sense, that other people probably are too. And I subsequently then carried out some really interesting survey research that showed that people in the job are spending about 40% of their time, 40% of their time on the job, persuading, influencing, convincing other people to give up what they have in exchange for what we have, what I call non-sales selling. And so, like it or not, today we're all in sales.
So you have used the word several times in that brief answer, which the word being persuasion. Is there a fundamental difference between selling, sales, and persuading?
I think there is a difference. That is, when I persuade you, I'm trying to change your mind. When I sell you, it's actually more dramatic. It's a bigger deal. What I'm trying to do is get you to give up resources of some kind, to make an exchange with me. So I say to you, you know, you give up your time and attention, and I'll give you something in return. So it's not simply saying I want you to agree with me. I want you to think that vanilla is the best flavor of ice cream, or right, that Republicans are the better political party. What I'm trying to do is get you to act, and in the process get you to give up something and make an exchange with me.
And were we always like this, in the sense of, are you finding that this is a change, that this is a progression, or do you feel that this has always been a part of human nature?
Well, I think it's a little bit of both. I mean, I out of the three options, I'd pick progression. That is, at some level, we've always done something like this. We've always had salespeople. I think that there are some big changes, though, in both the composition of what people do and in how they actually do it. For instance, right now you have 1 in 9 Americans who works in sales. That is, their job is to get people to buy something. 15 million people work essentially trying to get other people to make a purchase. That's a very large number of people and a significant part of our economy. But also, as I mentioned earlier, that the other 8 in 9 are in sales too, that they're spending a big portion of their time doing this non-sales selling. And I think the reason why we have so many people doing it actually does represent a change. First of all, you have more small entrepreneurs now. Technology has enabled much greater entrepreneurship, and anybody who's an entrepreneur is selling. If you look inside of established companies, there's much greater elasticity in what people do on the job. Work roles used to be highly segmented. Now they're more elastic. And so I've written about some companies. It's totally weird. A software company, for instance, that has 300 $100 million a year in sales, $250 million a year in sales, and they have no salespeople because their view is no one's in sales because everyone's in sales.
Mm.
And then if you also look at where the job growth is over the last 10 years, the job growth is significantly in this country in education and healthcare services, what I call EdMed. And those professions, teachers, nurses, physicians, educators writ large, are all in the business of moving other people. And so I think it's much more, it's always been a part of our lives. It's much more prominent today because of these economic forces. And it's also a different thing today. You know, in the old days, whatever you were selling, sellers had a big advantage. They had an advantage of information. The sellers almost always knew more than the buyers. That's not true anymore. And so I think we've gone from a world of buyer beware. Buyers have to beware when sellers have a lot more information and buyers don't have many choices or a way to talk back. I think today we're in a world of seller beware. When buyers have as much information as sellers and the means to talk back, the sellers are on notice, and I think that forces them much more to the high road and forces them to draw on a different set of qualities, many of which I think are more fundamentally human than the old-fashioned, glad-handing, slick approach.
When you talk about this non-sales sales and compare it to the traditional salesperson who is out there and has a goal and meets it and say, okay, we want you to sell this much, and you do or you exceed that, you can tell when you are being successful.
Mm.
How is the other form of sales monitored and quantified?
It's a really good question. To some extent, it's not, you can't quantify it with the same precision that you do selling computer equipment or swimming pool cleaning gear. But I do think that there's important to come up with various kinds of metrics and ways for people to get feedback. One way that people get better at something is if they're getting information on how they're doing. And in non-sales selling, the information is a little bit murkier. And so I think that companies especially have to look for ways to give people better, richer, more relevant feedback on these kinds of things. And also individuals have to look for ways to get feedback from their environment on their efforts to influence and convince and sell other people. But it's a really good point that we don't have highly developed metrics or mechanisms for doing that.
So how do we know when we've been sold then?
I think the idea, it's an interesting question too. No one likes to be sold.
Right.
And I think that what we have to do is get past this idea that selling is something that one person does to another. It's actually a way, the most effective form of sales is when I help you see that together we have common ground, that you and I have something that we share, we have a shared interest, and that by moving in this direction, we're both going to be better off. We don't think of it as saying, I'm going to take something from you to make me better off. What we have to do is look for the shared territory, the shared common ground, and look for ways to move to that. The other thing is that probably the most effective form of influence or selling is by looking for ways for the other person to come to his or her own reasons for agreeing with you.
Mm.
Not for me, Joe, to say, to sort of force my opinion on you or to get you to kind of bludgeon you into agreeing with me, but to say, to look into your own world, your own life, and come up with your own reasons for agreeing with me. That's when people come up with their own reasons for agreeing with you, they believe it more deeply, they adhere to it more strongly, and that's really our objective. You have to get past this notion that sales is something that people do to each other when it's actually far more collaborative, far more about common ground, far more about getting people to elicit their own intrinsically motivated, autonomous reasons for agreeing.
But if I'm reading this right, there is at some point, there is a person who would be identified as, for perhaps one of a better term, as the buyer, and they take some sort of action.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right. But the thing is, the buyer has to, what you want is, you want the buyer to say, wow, this is actually something that is very worthwhile for me. I'm not being coerced into this. I'm not being forced into this. That I'm making an autonomous choice because buying this will leave me better off than when I began.
Interestingly enough, you said that many of us and I think you're right, many of us don't like being sold things. I would also argue that I think many of us don't like to be thought of as selling things either sometimes.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, there's a lot of evidence of this. We think of selling as, I mean, I did this part of the research for this book. I went out and did a survey of 7,000 adult full-time workers trying to get a sense of what they did every day. But I also asked this question to them. I said, when you think of sales or selling, what's the first word that comes to mind? And when you look at the adjectives that people give in response to that question, they're 4-to-1 negative. There are words like sleazy, slimy, manipulative, dishonest. And selling has a very, very bad reputation. And that's why people kind of recoil at the whole idea, at saying, oh my gosh, you're in sales. Blech, that's terrible for me. But I think that's an old-fashioned view. I think that's a view of sales that's much more about information asymmetry than it is about the act of selling itself. When sellers know a lot more than buyers, and that was our world for a long time, when sellers know a lot more than buyers, they can be slimy and sleazy and cheesy. When buyers know as much as sellers, that those kinds of underhanded tactics don't work.
We've touched on this briefly, and as I mentioned in the introduction, you talk in the book about this new approach to moving people that involves three very human qualities and four surprising skills. We've circled around them a little bit, but give us a sense of what you're talking about there.
Sure. I mean, let's talk about the qualities. It's the new ABCs. We've gone, the old-fashioned form of sales is ABC, A always, BBC, closing, always be closing, relentless, shark-like, steamroller, get them to sign on the line which is dotted. I think they've been replaced by the new ABCs, which are attunement, buoyancy, and clarity. A, attunement, B, buoyancy, C, clarity. Attunement is perspective taking. How do you take someone else's perspective? Absolutely essential in any sort of effort to influence, sell, persuade another person. B, buoyancy. One reason, going back to your earlier question, people don't like sales is that they get rejected. No one likes rejected. So buoyancy is, what does the social science tell us about how to stay buoyant on that ocean of rejection? And C is clarity. We now don't live in a world where there's an information imbalance. Indeed, we live in a world where there's an information surplus, a blizzard of information. And so how do you make sense of that information? How do you curate it, distill it, take it out of the world of murkiness into something that is much more clear? How do you frame messages in ways that we, social science tells us, provide clarity to people in an effort to get them to act?
And when it comes to the skills?
Yeah, there are three particular skills that matter most: to pitch, to improvise, and to serve. We are pitching all the time. Every email, for instance, is a pitch. People are distracted and you're vying for attention. So how do you distill your message in a pitch that is compelling and leads to engagement? Improvise. What do you do when you're perfectly attuned, appropriately buoyant, super clear pitch goes awry, as it will, inevitably? How do you respond to that? The lessons of improvisational theater give us a lot of clues. And finally, serve. We have to get back to thinking of selling as an act of service, not as a form of manipulation, not as something that one person does to basically extract resources from another, but something that somebody does to leave another and the entire world slightly better off.
It's a new way of thinking of things. So it should ultimately be something that comes rather subconsciously to us.
It's a mix. It's an interesting question, too. It's a mix of both conscious and subconscious. I mean, I think that people need to commit themselves to getting better at this. And again, if you harvest the social science, you'll find enormous, really practical tools and tips to get better at these kinds of things. So actually being conscious of it is really important. On the other hand, there is a certain level of unconsciousness, because what matters most today are things that are fundamentally human, that if you act like a human being, if you stop trying to be, you know, thinking that sales is about sleazebaggery and hoodwinkery, and start essentially acting the way that I think human beings want to act, which is with integrity, which is with authenticity, which is with trying to understand people, then I think you're actually more effective at it.
When you look at something like this and you put it together, how do you, Daniel Pink, put on the training wheels and figure out that it works?
Well, all kinds of ways. First, I mean, again, instead of going to like the old grizzled sales veterans who have some good points, but maybe not a lot of good points, or conventional wisdom, I looked at what does the social science tell us about this? And so I look at the social science, see what evidence it provides, see whether that evidence is credible. But then, as you say, I test it out myself. So let's think about pitching via email. Every email subject line, as I mentioned, is a pitch. There's research out of Carnegie Mellon showing us how to write more effective email subject lines. And what they tell us very clearly is that the most effective email subject lines appeal either to utility or to curiosity. They state very clearly, this is going to be useful to your work, or they create some uncertainty to pique curiosity. And so I've tried to adapt that myself by having email subject lines, going through my email subject lines and saying, is this clear from the subject line that this mail is going to be immediately useful to somebody, or short of that, will it make them curious? But flabby in the middle subject lines like question or follow-up, I try to avoid.
It would seem to me that the utility would be the more difficult of the two, because it does come off more overtly as salesy.
Yeah, but it's much more welcome for people. So again, forget about. Let's think about. Let's say that you and I are colleagues in a company, and your thankless job is that our copy machine broke down, and you have to go find another copy machine for our office. Well, if I send you an email saying follow up, you might not open it. But if I send you an email saying three good sources for low price copy machines, you might open that because it's directly relevant to you.
Hmm. And it's sort of knowing also our own curiosity of knowing what is going on so that we can figure out how to utilitize it.
Right. So I mean, the lessons from Carnegie Mellon are appeal to curiosity or appeal to utility, but don't get caught in the middle with you know, I can't tell you how many times I get emails about that say, question.
Yeah.
Right? Well, question about what? And like, why is this urgent for me to answer this question? Those kinds of things end up not getting open. And so if you appeal to utility or curiosity, you're more likely to get your email opened. You're more likely to begin the engagement that emails often triggers.
And it gets, I mean, I certainly feel this way. I think a lot of people feel this way. And you talked about the competition for email, but you just get to the point where it's just too much. And in any case, you're probably not spending nearly the time that you should if you're doing, you know, what you actually want to do, which is carefully look at everything.
That's a very, very good point, too. And what the same research shows is that utility is more effective when people have a very heavy email load, and curiosity is more effective when people's email load is lighter. So if you know, if you have a sense of the email load of the recipient, if it's heavy, go to with utility. If it's not as heavy, go to curiosity. The other thing is, just in terms of pitching more generally, is that I would say that 98% of the emails that I receive from people are too long. And many of us are scanning these emails. So how do you make your email like one line, two lines? How do you make it in some ways more like a tweet than like a handwritten letter sent in 1860?
And you talk interestingly in the book about this shift in the balance that really it is more, instead of buyer beware, it's seller beware, that the seller has to be more on the ball, giving ultimately the buyer more power.
Precisely. When buyers have, you know, I go, okay, here we go. You're a Chevy dealer. I'm interested in buying a Chevy. 20 years ago, if I walked into your dealership, you knew, you had a huge information advantage. You knew a lot more about cars, a lot more about Chevys than I ever could. Now, I go into your Chevy dealership, I can know as much about cars, as much about Chevys as you. Mm-hmm. I can find the factory invoice price. I can understand what other dealers in the area are charging for it. I can go to a user group of people who've already bought the car, letting me know the idiosyncrasies. And so so if I go in with the same amount of more information than you, and I also have a lot of choices, and I have a way to talk back if you do hoodwink me, you're the one now on notice. And what that means is that it's driving people much more to the high road of greater, not everywhere, not in every single transaction, but of greater honesty, greater transparency, and also people becoming more effective by tapping these more fundamentally human values of attunement, buoyancy, and clarity.
Daniel Pink's new book is To Sell Is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. It's published by Riverhead Books. Daniel, it's always a pleasure having you on the program. I thank you very much for sharing your ideas with us.
Joe, thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Great pleasure. Thank you. Again, Daniel Pink's book, To Sell Is Human, The Surprising Truth About Moving Others. It is published by Riverhead. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.